Home Alan, Reel 5. So, when we left off, the steam had just been cut off and the ship was out of action.
Yes, the ship was out of action and was getting slower and slower. Meanwhile, I was up in the crow's nest, looking around with my binoculars, and then I looked down and I saw we were going very, very slowly, and I thought, that's very odd. And then I looked down at the bridge, and there was nobody there. And I looked aft, and there were people jumping over the side. And I thought, well, that's not very kind to abandon ship without telling me. And I must confess that I did pass through my mind, from what I had read when I was reading the boy's own paper as a young man, that, you know, you had to stay at your post until ordered to leave. But I thought, well, frankly, I think that's for the birds. We're off. So I told this Audrey Seaman to get going, and we climbed down, and I got to the quarterdeck. There was a Kali raft, and I got to the quarterdeck. There was a Kali raft on the quarterdeck, one of these big sausage-shaped things, you know, grey things with a sort of raft and a lattice in the middle. And a few people were dismantling this, ready to throw it over the side. So we got it on the handrail, and somebody said, ready, one, two, three, and we'll jump. And over it goes, we jump after it. When one of them, I think it was a chief shipwright, said, I can't swim. So they said, it doesn't matter, we'll hang on to you. So over went the raft, in we went, taking care to keep well clear of the propellers, and we all scrambled on the raft. I wasn't on it more than about an hour and a half at that, because I was like, a Japanese destroyer loomed up with a large pom-pom, which was on it, and I noticed to my dismay that this pom-pom was being trained around and pointing in our direction. So we just kept our fingers crossed that they wouldn't press the trigger. And those of us, some of us dived off and swam towards the destroyer, which is where we were picked up. And all the officers put us forward on the forecastle underneath the eye of the bridge, and the ship's company behind. And I must say, the Japanese Navy were very good. They picked everybody up because there was quite an affinity between the Japanese Navy and the British Navy, really, because the Japanese Navy had a large British element training them in the after the First World War. And there was, you know, a considerable amount of, you might say, respect. But it didn't stop them, of course, from going ahead on their own steam through the 30s and developing in a way which we certainly had never dreamed of doing.
Mm. Can I just ask you, do you remember the name of the Glaswegian who was up there?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I really don't. I just don't know. Mm. I had no idea.
He was quite a voluble character, was he?
No. He was just a very scared young man, same as I was, you know. No, he was... I don't remember him, I'm afraid. Right. I do remember that. Right.
So what was this that actually prompted? I mean, the order presumably had been given to abandon ship.
Well, the thing was, you see, that the captain realised, A, he was out of shell, so he couldn't fight the ship any longer. Mm. B, he had no power. Mm. And, of course, the tremendous disaster would have been if the Japanese had boarded the ship and captured it. That would have been the end. And so the important thing then was to scuttle it. And he gave the order to open all the seacocks and put some explosive charges, I think, which is what they did, you see, and the ship just sank. So that was the important thing, to make sure she went to the bottom.
So the Japanese ship that you got onto, what was that like?
Well, it was a destroyer. Mm. It was very crowded. And there was, you know, they were hard put to deal with this influx. But looking back now, they certainly did all they could and provided a modicum of food and biscuits and condensed milk, if I remember right. Excuse me. And eventually they got rid of us by taking us into Borneo to a little port called Banjarmasin, I think it was, Banjarmasin, where they put us all on board an oiler, just because it was a place to put us. And we were there for a day or so, and then they transferred us to a Dutch hospital ship, which they had captured, quite contrary to Geneva Convention, but they put us on board this Dutch hospital ship. The officers were put into a ward, so we had cots to sleep on. The other ranks were put into a hold, and there was hardly any food at all. What the Dutch ship's company were doing, I don't know, but probably they were feeding all right. But they didn't have any food for the prisoners. I mean, in a way, you can understand the Dutch crew and captain that they were obviously affronted that they should have been, that the laws of war should have been so forgotten, and that they should have been captured by the Japanese. But certainly we saw nothing of them, and they kept a low profile, and we were very, very hungry indeed. So much so that some other midshipmen and I thought, well, the thing to do, laws of war notwithstanding, is to see if we can find some iron rations in the lifeboats. So we crept out at night and crept up to the deck and above and started rummaging about, but we were soon spotted by one of the Malay crew of the hospital ship, who I think reported it to his senior officers, who reported it to our senior officer, who gave us both terrible wigging and confined us to our bunks for the rest of the time there. So we were very fed up. It was only later on when, after we'd been prisoner for 2 or 3 years, I met one of the petty officers who said, oh, you know, that terrible hospital ship, we were starving. He said, but we managed to get some food. I said, oh, yes. He said, we went to the lifeboats and managed to get some out. Oh, I said, well done. I didn't confess that we'd also tried it, but we hadn't been quite so expert at thieving as they were. Oh, that's by the way.
Yeah. What did you think was going to happen to you all? I mean, did you have any opinions about being a Japanese prisoner of war?
No, we had first, of course, any protests which had been made to Japanese were sort of brushed off, because this was, we were in a state of limbo. We hadn't been put anywhere in particular. But as soon as we got to Makassar, where we were put ashore there, and we were taken to a camp, any attempt then to cite the Geneva Convention only created fury on the part of the Japanese, who usually beat up whoever was suggesting it. And as it was usually the senior officer, you know, it was, you realize you weren't going to get anywhere by talking of the Geneva Convention. And this is understandable in a way, because you see, A, the Japs hadn't ever signed it, and B, their view was that anybody, any soldier or sailor who had allowed themselves to be captured in battle, even if it wasn't their fault, had sacrificed everything. You'd lost all honor completely. And if it wasn't your fault when you were captured, then you should kill yourself. We knew this from beforehand, that HMS Jupiter had sunk a Japanese destroyer in the Sunda Straits before March the 1st, before we were captured. And there were, I think, two survivors, both of whom were picked up unconscious. And they came round when they were in the sick bay being looked after. And the first thing these chaps did was to try to kill themselves. And so they had to put them on. And this applied also, I think, to an awful lot of Japanese during the war, though in the later part of the war, of course, there were many who cheerfully accepted the fact they were prisoners, and they weren't quite so brainwashed about the whole thing. But in those early days, it was certainly regarded us as having lost all honour. We were beneath contempt, and therefore, you know, it was jolly nice, it was jolly decent of the Japanese to keep us alive at all.
Right. So how long were you on the hospital ship?
Oh, perhaps 10 days, I think, if that, about 10 days.
And what procedure were you put through when you actually got off the hospital ship?
Well, very little, really. We were lined up on the deck, on the docks in Celebes, and at Makassar, and marched off. And I might say that, you know, it is interesting that you have a group of people who are an organized body of sailors or whatever, one day, and then after action and a bit of hardship, you see them as prisoners, and they certainly look a very demoralized and sad sight. Really, it's... of course, we were paraded through Macassar to this camp, and the locals were encouraged to stand around and see the downfall of the hated Westerners. And of course, the Westerners, the Dutch, were very much disliked in the East Indies. They had a very repressive rule. The only curious thing was that many of the Dutch, you know, couldn't believe that they were so disliked, and they were quite surprised. However,
what was the camp like?
Well, the camp was a Dutch army camp, which had been a Dutch army barracks. It was called the Cycle Camp. I don't quite know why. No, I'm sorry, it wasn't. It was in Batavia. It was a Dutch army barracks, and as such, it was really quite a comfortable place. Except you had a big notice over the gate as you went out in Malay saying, "Are you correctly dressed?" And then there was a guard room and an office. When we went there first, all the officers were put into the office very near the guard room, and the men were spread about. Later on, we were different parts of the camp were given over to different people. There was a short spell when all the midshipmen were put into two rather nice little bungalows for the non-commissioned officers, and we were very comfortable there in a little compound with a fence around us and plenty of warning if the Japs came around. But we were soon moved out of that. And we were in long, low barracks with benches to sleep on. But it was quite a well-run camp. There was a very big ablutions area. One was the loos, which were worked on a very economical principle. They had two long troughs in the ground. Above, around those were cubicles, and you squatted over the troughs. And the troughs were cleaned out by means of a big tipping tank at the end. So you had this big tank on swivels and a tap running into it. And when the tank filled up, the center of gravity shifted, and it went over with a great clang, and a great whoosh of water went down the trenches and cleaned all out, which was very efficient. And it meant you had a steady, small supply of water instead of a large amount, really. The ablutions were really rather nice. They were low huts. Inside it was a big tank of water, I mean a large tank, perhaps 5 meters by 5 meters and about a meter deep. And the technique was to go in there and with a piece of soap if you had it and a tin or bucket and bail out over yourself, just pour it out over yourself. See, so the water was always clean. When we first got there, of course, the English matelows had never seen this technique, and they all dived into the tank, but the Dutch were very fair about that, because they were Dutch in there as well, and they explained that that was not the way to do it. So it was all a very, for tropical conditions, not bad, you see. The usual thing, the discomfort of living there was chiefly, of course, the fact there wasn't enough food and the Japanese. Soon after we were there, the camp was taken over, administered by a man who I think was probably in the Kempeitai, that is the Japanese Gestapo. But he was quite a low rank. We think he was a leading seaman or a corporal. But he was a man called Yoshida, and he had a great big gold tooth in his mouth, so he was called Gold Tooth. And he was a maniac, and he would beat anybody up on the smallest consideration. And he was a definite, an evil man. He was hanged after all because he caused the deaths of lots of people. And what did I say about Yoshida? Oh, yes. First of all, we hadn't been in there more than about a fortnight before three Dutchmen decided to try to escape. And they were local people, One of them was a very sort of tough bloke who'd, I think, canoed all the way from Holland to the East Indies in the 30s. And another man was a local chap. And they all knew their way around. And they fluent Malay. They had friends amongst the Malays, also they thought. And they made a break for it. Well, that wasn't difficult because there was only a sort of bit of a fence around. But as soon as, of course, as soon as they got out, they were turned in by the local Malays who weren't going to help any Dutchmen. And the Japanese treated them terribly. I mean, they were beaten up and they were beaten up and made to dig their own graves, and eventually they were executed. So this was, of course, an awful warning to everybody else. And my friend Sam Fall was one who was also going to make a break for it. And after this, the senior officers said, nobody on any account is going to try this again, because amongst the Dutchman's friends who were left behind, the huts they had been sleeping, everybody in the huts were beaten up. I mean, everybody who had anything to do with them at all were put on, you know, nil rations and heat. So it really was not a proposition.
How was your morale these first weeks or months in the camp? I mean, you were a young man. What was your
20th birthday there soon after we captured.
Were you demoralised?
Well, not really, you see, because everybody was terribly optimistic, quite unjustifiably so, but nevertheless. And we all used to say, oh, it can't be, the war can't possibly last much longer. But I mean, really, you know, the Japs will soon be driven out of the Philippines. It can't be, you see, with Americans coming, you know, that can't last much longer. And we were really absurdly optimistic, whereas the Dutch were much more realistic, I think, and we were rather amused, really, because there were one or two Dutchmen who were very gloomy, and they'd go around to say, oh, there is no hope. So this there is no hope became a sort of catchphrase amongst some of the English, you see, and kept us all amused for a bit. So we never dreamed that we'd be in there for nearly 4 years, you know. We, I mean, obviously, just as well, we didn't.
You mentioned the officers taking a lead. I mean, how much did their authority continue in the camp?
Quite well, on the whole. I mean, the senior officers, the captain and the senior officers in the ship, were all shipped off to Japan soon after we were captured. And the captain's written a book about his experiences, and they were treated pretty severely, though, by all, you know, and of course interrogated, and but those who were left behind, and the senior officer left behind for us was Lieutenant Commander, who was the first lieutenant of the Exeter. He was quite, of course, there were other officers as well. You see, there were army officers from, they'd been in Java, had been scooped up, and there were Air Force officers. But for a time, our senior officer was quite firm with the men concerned. I mean, he couldn't, exercise King's regulations, of course. But he pointed out, you know, now in certain terms, that while they were in prison there, their wives were being, you know, maintained at government expense because of it, you see, and their pay was waiting for them when they got back, and they're still, you know, under naval discipline, don't you forget it. And, you know, he was a strong character and carried his way. So on the whole, it was the officers, I think, it certainly lived up to their responsibilities.
Did you have much contact with the ratings?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, we did for the first 18 months, because after about 9 months in prison in Makassar, in Celebes, a group of about 60 were sent from Makassar around to the southern end of the island, called a place called Pomala, which was a where there was an ore mine. And this group of prisoners was going to work in the mines or build a jetty or generally make themselves useful in this godforsaken spot. You know, Celebes is rather like a spider's web, a spider, curious, it's now Sulawesi, but the bottom has a big gulf, and we were up this gulf. When we were taken to it on board a Japanese cargo ship, which was used for iron ore, and we were just shoved down into the hold and with our fingers crossed. But we got round without any difficulty and found ourselves in this new camp, and which was very, very primitive. There was some low huts, atap huts, with benches of bamboo, split bamboo, about a foot off the ground. They gave you about 6 foot by 2 feet per person, and there's a sort of table down the middle, made of bamboo. And there were six of these huts, and there were some latrines in between them, and a sort of cookhouse, and that was it. It was soon clear that, what with sickness, we weren't going to be much use to the Japs, so they put us on to a bit of sort of jungle clearing at one, about half a mile from the camp. And there was a strong urge for officers to work at shoveling with the men. And this was resisted because we thought this was a bad precedent to set, and we had to invoke the Geneva Convention, which didn't do much good. But in the end, we compromised, and we said, well, the officers all work. We'll be responsible for the men's working party, so there will be two or three officers who would be working, be with the men, supervising. When I say supervising, it really was to, their job was to get the Japanese guards in conversation and distract their attention so they didn't notice how little work was actually being done. The other officers would go off into the jungle and with axes and hammers and things, and cut down wood and timber and split it up for the camp kitchen. And by getting this job organized, one could really do most of the work in the cool of the morning, and by the time it got too hot, one would be able to sit down and do some reading. We had some books, I'm glad to say, which came from Macassar, from Dutchman's libraries, which were very lucky. And I remember reading David Copperfield there, and also some books on socialism by G.D.H. Cole.
Did you have any contact with home? Did you get any mail? Or?
No. No, there might have been one occasion when we could send a postcard, one or two, but that's all. We certainly were able to send one postcard, and that did get home after about some months. I think when we'd been prisoners about 8 or 9 months, I think. But my parents, you see, were in a particularly bad position in that there was this delay in getting any news about us from London, say. So, you see, my parents knew I was in the Navy. They knew I was in the Prince of Wales. Remember, in May 1940, they were under German occupation. They knew I was in the Prince of Wales. Then, of course, they knew the Prince of Wales was sunk, because everybody told them so, Germans told them so. But on the other hand, they didn't know whether I was safe. And then they eventually knew that I was on the Exeter. And then they heard that I was safe from the Prince of Wales. But they didn't know I was safe from the Exeter. So there was a long delay, when, you know, hope deferred, that sort of things. It must have been tough for them, but they didn't know.
Did you get Red Cross parcels?
Oh, Red Cross parcels. Well, not at that stage. Later on, there was a delivery of Red Cross parcels. And there was half a parcel per man. Of course, I mean, lots of parcels were sent, but the Japanese just took the lot, normally. But anyway, for some reason, these got through. Half a parcel per man. And this was marvelous, because at that time, we were getting very, very short of vitamins, and beriberi was rife. And I remember now that although as a child I'd never liked prunes at all, and had to be urged by my mother to eat them, there were some dried prunes, and they tasted absolutely marvellous, because I suppose one was short of iron, you know. Yes, we got that, and then on another occasion, there was a delivery of Red Cross parcels, and we got one parcel between 16. So the total number of parcels received was 9/16 per man. However, not surprising really, because by the time the war was well advanced, I mean, it was almost impossible to keep the Japanese communications between the East Indies or the Philippines and Japan was, you know, were terribly stretched. But that's all we got in the way of Red Cross parcels.
Sorry, I interrupted your chronology, so...
Oh, sorry, where were we? Oh, so just by the way, so not that can, a later can, I remember, there was a particular hate on. It was soon after these poor chaps were killed after trying to escape. And the Japanese thought it appropriate, and not a bad idea really, that everybody should have their hair shaved off. Up to that point, you see, our hair was a reasonable length, ordinary length, and people had grown beards. Some had grown very fine beards. But these all had to come off. And the order was given that everything was to be shaved off. I must say that some people took this extremely hard. You wouldn't have thought the men could be so vain, but they really thought it was... And one particular chap who was a young lieutenant of Marines, who was very, very proud of his moustache, which he cultivated very carefully with his toothbrush and, you know, nice little military moustache. He was horrified that he had to, after all these, you know, careful cultivation, he'd have to go. So it went. So we all were paraded on in front of the Japs, in front of this dreadful fellow, Yoshida, to check that it's all been done. And if he could pick, if he could hold the hairs between his forefinger and thumb, that was too long, and you got a wallop in the jaw and sent back to it again, or worse. Well, one American sailor thought, he as I just thought that, well, you were told the hair had to come off and the beards had to come off, but nobody mentioned sideburns, did they? So this damn fool left his sideboards on. Well, Yoshida went mad, and he pulled out horrible. He pulled out of his pocket a pair of pliers and proceeded to pull it out himself. So this chap didn't. He got the hint, you see, and he got beaten up and eventually. But that was the sort of thing. You never knew which way the Japs would jump. I mean, later on, we found the sickness at this little place, Pomala, was so bad that the Japs realized they were not going to get anything out of us, and they shipped us back to Makassar. The only light relief at... two bits of light relief at Pomala, this camp. We used to, go along to this jungle clearing and clear some land for more bungalows to be built, because there were a couple of planters' bungalows there which were used by Japanese women, and they had some nurses there, nurses and secretaries. And every afternoon at 5 o'clock, say, we'd be coming back to the camp, and we would cross a river, and if the Japs were in a good mood, we could have a bath in there, which would save all the ablutions in the camp, you see. So we'd clean ourselves up in the river. So everybody used to strip off, stark naked, and we'd be bouncing about in the river and doing our washing. Of course, you'd wash the clothes you had on, you see, which is very handy. Then along, there'd be a cloud of dust in the distance. Along the road would come these cars. And then the Japanese guards got very agitated, and we all had to keep ducked down under the water so that these ladies... susceptibilities would not see a naked man, you see, and they'd all go past their noses in the air. Sometimes you see them bounce. On other days, they have a day off, and they'd be going through the woods with little short women, you see, with round short legs and with butterfly hunting, you see, but all turning their nose up very much at these dirty prisoners, of course. And another occasion, the Japs sent in some meat to the camp. Well, this was a great day, and it was a buffalo, water buffalo. So the water buffalo was brought into the camp, poor animal, and tied up to a post of the cookhouse. And then along came one of the Japanese guards and produced his rifle and proceeded to shoot it. So he shot it at pretty well point blank range, but he still missed it. Instead of hitting it square through the head, through the forehead, it sort of glanced off. This annoyed the buffalo considerably. It wrenched itself clear of the tether, galloped round the camp, and down the road. So, of course, everybody was quite excited about this.